Bird Lives, looking for Chet Baker. And Bill Moody's latest novel, Fade to Blue, involved jazz pianist Evan Horn, who solves crimes steeped in the world of jazz. Bill Moody joined Sonoma County's Jazz MD and longtime host of KRCB's Jazz Connections, Larry Slater, in conversation about jazz and the improvisation of writing. Novelist Stacy Carlson brings us a taxidermist, a beluga whale, conjoined twins, and the tallest woman in the world, all in P.T. Barnum's American Museum, set in 19th century New York City, in her book, Among the Wonderful. And Elizabeth Kern explores a woman's coming of age amidst a Polish community in 1960s Chicago in wanting to be Jackie Kennedy. I'm Suzanne Lang with Rosemary Manchester and guest host Larry Slater, all coming up right here. It's a novel idea. Stay with us. Bill Moody is a mystery author and professional jazz drummer. He spent 20 years playing music on the Vegas Strip before relocating to Northern California, where his career as a novelist and writing teacher took off. He's the author of 6 Evan Horn mysteries, and here he talks with Larry Slater.
Hi, this is Larry Slater, Sonoma County's Jazz MD, and Bill Moody is my guest today on A Novel Idea. Bill's a jazz drummer who has played or recorded with the likes of Maynard Ferguson, John Hendricks, and Lou Rawls. But Bill has found a second career as an author and the inventor of a new literary idiom, the jazz mystery. Bill Moody, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Bill, tell us a bit about your career both as a jazz musician and how you came to writing from jazz. I think you'd have to agree it is not the usual career path for a musician.
No, it's not. I know one other drummer, though, who did some writing, Dave Tough from old Chicago group. In fact, when he was on cruises to France, I was told he wrote limericks with F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Is that right?
And the King Edward VIII was on the ship a couple of times, and he let him set in on drums. And they asked Dave, what kind of drummer would he make? And he said, well, he'd be a pretty good king, probably. That was it, you know. I was pretty self-taught. My mother was a pianist, and I used to set up my drums in the living room and play with her. And then I went to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And at that time, Berklee was very small. It was only 400 or 500 students, and all of the teachers were still working musicians. As far as the writing, it just always came fairly easy for me. But I didn't really pursue it, but after I got on the road, I wrote some articles for Downbeat and some of the jazz magazines. And then when I went back to school, I did a paper on jazz and fiction. And I got a bunch of these books that were out of print and everything that was available. And most of it was pretty bad. You could tell the authors liked jazz, but they didn't really know a lot about it. So I thought, well, I can at least write about jazz from the inside. So I wrote a short story and it got published in a collection called Bebop, B-flat, Scat. And it was short fiction and poetry. Then I wrote a couple of other stories and somebody said, why don't you try a novel? You know, and I thought, well, maybe I could do that. And they said, you could make it a mystery, a jazz mystery novel. So I started looking around and realized there was a lot of material, a lot of mysterious events in jazz history that have never been solved, and that's what I did, and I started that one with the Wardell Gray story for Death of a Tenor Man.
But your protagonist is a fellow named Evan Horn, right?
Right.
But you're a drummer, and Evan Horn is a pianist.
Right.
Why is Evan Horn a pianist?
I didn't want Evan Horn to have to carry a set of drums around with him onto gigs, and I do play a little piano, not enough to scare anybody, and I figured that audience would relate more to piano than to drums anyway. So I just saved Evan the trouble of lugging a set of drums around.
Did you have to learn about playing the piano?
My mother was quite a classical pianist, so I had the usual childhood piano lessons, which I took off and on, and then I fooled around on my own some, and so I, you know, I could play chords and things, and I knew enough about it, and I, of course, I worked with enough piano players that any of them that I needed information from, I could get to, and the one thing I gave Evan was just as a part of his character was an injury before the first book starts. He's in an automobile crash and damages the tendons on his right hand or solo hand, and that was the title of the first book, Solo Hand. Because I had worked with a couple of pianists who were having problems with arthritis or various other muscular problems. So that was a whole area. So all through the books, I have Evan off and on getting better and getting, you know, and lapsing back. And a lot of readers at reading signings, they'll say, is, we hope Evan is better now. You know, and I said, yeah, he's getting better. Don't worry.
Bill, where do the ideas for your books come from? Obviously, you're steeped in jazz history. You've had the mysterious death of Chet Baker in Amsterdam, Wardell Gray, who was the tenor saxophonist in the 40s, who was found dead outside of Las Vegas. Where do the ideas come from? Oh, and you had a book on Clifford Brown as well.
Right. I start off just with a premise, and I don't know where I'm going to go with it, but with the Clifford Brown book's a good example of Sound of the Trumpet. I thought, what if somebody discovered some recordings that nobody had known about of Clifford Brown? And I picked Clifford Brown because he died so young. He was only 25. He died in a car crash, so there wasn't any mystery there. But he didn't record all that much compared to Miles Davis and Chet Baker, people like that. But I thought if they were discovered, how much would these tapes be worth? Who would want them? How valuable would they be? And so on. So that was the premise. And I started off, and I always intended for the recordings to be authentic. And I had Evan hired by somebody to authenticate the tapes, you know. Then about halfway through the book, I thought, well, what if these are not Clifford Brown? What if it's somebody imitating Clifford Brown? Why would they do that, and how would that affect things? Well, I went along with that, and it, I think, made the book better. And I found that I tried several musicians who said that, yes, somebody could fool them into believing that this trumpet player was Clifford Brown. And there's a guy in San Diego, Charles McPherson, who was in the movie Bird, and he can fool anybody into thinking that he's Charlie Parker. But what was the most interesting part was I never talked to Clifford's widow, LaRue. I just didn't feel like I needed to, and her husband had been killed in a car crash, and I have a couple of scenes of that. But she called me after the book came out, and she said, I just wanted you to know I really enjoyed the book. And she said, but what I wanted to tell you is that we have found some tapes of Clifford Brown almost the same way you made it up in the book. And they had been discovered by another trumpet player, Bobby Shue, who lives in L.A. And he was talking to this guy who had a club in West Virginia, I think it was. And he said, oh, yeah, my grandfather ran this club, and he recorded everybody that came through. And he recorded so-and-so and so-and-so and Clifford Brown. And Bobby said, wait a minute. He recorded Clifford Brown? And he says, oh, yeah, and there was another guy with him, Sonny Rollins, and it was the whole Clifford Brown, Max Roach band on tour. Well, they found these tapes, and they were in very good condition, and Bobby sent me a copy of one of them. The sound quality was very good. And LaRue Brown told me that Blue Note planned to bring out a 2-CD set, the lost Clifford Brown tapes, but Max Roach held everything up. He wanted an enormous amount of money, and he prevented things, you know, happening when they should have. But I think eventually they will come out. It would be a shame for them not to, I think, you know.
Yeah, they'd be a real treasure. And, of course, we have had a few examples just in the last couple of years. There was the Charlie Parker thing that was found in a tape in a pawn shop somewhere up in Boston. So it's a good premise because it's real.
So that's what I do. And then with Chet Baker, there was all kinds of stories about what happened to Chet Baker. And by that time, I was living up here. And a pianist I work with every week, Terry Henry, was very good friends with Chet Baker. And a singer I worked with occasionally, Marigold Hill, whenever Chet was up in this area, he stayed at her house. I was at her house one time, and I saw a photo on the mantle, and it was Chet and her. It looked like her backyard. And she said, oh, yeah, Chet always stayed here when he came up. So I had all this personal information going on about Chet. And there were stories that he was pushed out of the window at this hotel in Amsterdam, or he fell off, or, you know, once I started, there were, everybody says, oh, I know what really happened. And every time I hear somebody say that, I know they didn't, you know. So Russ Freeman gave me an awful lot of material because he was Chet's pianist for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And I went to Amsterdam, and I went to the hotel, and I went to in the back of the hotel where he supposedly fell out, and just checked the whole thing out. And like in the Wardell Gray case, I don't solve the mystery, but I put out all this information, and then I let the readers decide which is the, you know, most viable explanation.
Bill, one of the things I remember from that book, Looking for Chet Baker, was when Evan Horn, the protagonist, is coming back from Amsterdam, and he's driving up to Sonoma County and turns on the radio and gets a smooth jazz station, which will remain unnamed, and he goes, oh, my God, and he turns off the station. And then you follow that with a book called Bird Lives, where smooth jazz artists are being murdered, and the murderer leaves a calling card, which is a bird feather, bird being the great alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. Mm-hmm. Obviously, many of us in the jazz world have very strong feelings about smooth jazz, and was this your way to express your feelings about smooth jazz, Bill?
Yeah, Bird Lives is probably the most popular book among musicians. The premise was, what if there's a serial killer killing smooth jazz musicians? As the book goes on, it's clear that it's not just about musical taste, and I couldn't actually use names like Kenny G, but everybody knows that's what we're talking about.
You know, in Bird Lives, you were dealing with our feelings about smooth jazz and how contemporary or mainstream jazz artists have such a difficult time making a living.
Mm-hmm.
So you've moved now into your new book, which deals with jazz artists working in Hollywood and working with film scores. It seemed like a natural transition.
That's the newest one, called Fade to Blue. And the premise in that is, what if some big Tom Cruise-like movie star hired Evan to teach him how to look like he was playing piano for a movie role? How would that work out? And again, I didn't know how that was going to happen. And I had, you know, a little bit of rubbing shoulders with celebrity, especially during a time with Lou Rawls. And in fact, Steve McQueen lived across the street from him, and he used to come over and we'd play pool in Lou's basement playroom. He had a pool table and jukebox and all this stuff, and also a couple of other TV actors. And we worked, you know, opposite a lot of stars, too. So I knew what it would be like. And I thought the clash between Evan and an arrogant, big-time movie star could be interesting, and it turned out it was. And then, as you say, moving into scoring music for movies, I made that something that Evan thought he might like to do. And that's how I end the book, with that scoring.
Bill, you've got a website where you draw some parallels between the improvisation in being a jazz musician and the improvising one does when one's writing a novel.
Yeah, for me, there's a very strong connection with jazz. You have the framework of the tune you're playing, but you don't know what you're going to play until you get there. You know, and people say, "Well, how do you know to play that?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do until I get there." And with writing, you have the framework of a novel, and particularly with a mystery novel, you have a crime and you have suspects and you have some kind of resolution. So, and then what you do with it, you improvise on that, which is exactly what I do. A lot of writers, though, outline the entire book first, which I've never been able to do. I did try it once, and it just doesn't work for me. I find a strong connection between improvising on music and improvising with the writing. I had a little brief friendship with the writer Tony Hillerman, who wrote about the Navajo Indian detective Jim Chi and Joe Leaphorn. And he told me he never outlined either. I was very glad to hear that. And he said for each of his novels, he picked a premise of some level of Navajo custom or legend. And he says, then I get in my Jeep and I drive out on the reservation and I look for a place where the first body's going to be found. And then I go from there. So I was very pleased to hear that. But since I've, you know, been involved with writing, it's just been much more comfortable for me to do it without outlining it. Like I said, I changed the Clifford Brown book halfway through it because it suddenly struck me that maybe this would be a different way to go.
So you start at the beginning with a concept,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know what the resolution is going to be, as opposed to coming up with a resolution and then coming backwards to build the story.
Yeah, exactly. All I know is how I'm going to start. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But so far, it's worked. Like Hillerman called it a discovery draft of the book. And he said he likened it to driving in the fog. You can see 100 feet or so ahead of you, and then you get to that point, and then you can see another 100 feet. So that's pretty much how I go, too. It's like when you're playing, you play the first chorus, and then you can look ahead to the next chorus, and then at some point there's going to be a bass solo, and then exchanges for the drums. And so you can see a little bit ahead each time, and that's how it's always been with me.
And our readers don't know that Evan Horn, the protagonist, has a CIA agent girlfriend.
Well, FBI, actually.
FBI, that's
right. Yeah, FBI. He met her during Bird Lives. She was a profiler, since they were dealing with a serial killer. And they developed into a relationship, and they're still together now. And he had previously been involved with another Santa Monica policewoman, and they broke up. And a couple of times at readings, some women got very mad because they were upset that Evan had broken up with Natalie, the cop, and taken off with this FBI agent. You know, in fact, at one time during a reading where I was sitting, there was a shelf, and I could hear these two women arguing on the other side, and they said, "Evan would never have done that." He's, you know, they were just really going at it, you know, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool because these are totally fictional characters. So he is still with Andy Lawrence, the FBI agent now.
Bill, is there a historical precedent here? I can't think of a jazz musician who's had a significant other in law enforcement.
Yeah, I have one of the characters in the Chet Baker book, Fletcher Page, the older musician that he says to Evan at one point, he says, "Man, you got a friend in the cops, your girlfriend is an FBI." So I never heard of a musician with so many law enforcement people connected to him. You know, so it works because Andy can help him with if he gets in trouble with federal involvement, and his friend Cooper can help him with you know, local stuff. Evan is not an official private detective, so he's not supposed to know all these police procedures.
And Evan does always seem to be in trouble.
That's been the tricky line to I mean, why would a jazz musician get involved in so many things like this? Plausibility has always been a big thing for me. I've read so many books where they offer somebody to do something and they just say, okay, and there's no reason for them to do this, you know. So I usually have it as starting off with Evan is doing a favor for somebody and then gets in over his head. And like the Clifford Brown, he's hired just to listen to these tapes and say whether he thinks they really are Clifford Brown or not. And everything escalates off of that.
Bill, with your careers, you've been a jazz musician, a jazz drummer most of your life, and an author for several years. You had a radio show in Las Vegas, you told me, and now you have one in Sonoma, and you taught creative writing at Sonoma State. Tell us a little bit about that, and let me know if you think that the act of coming up with jazz mysteries has been able to introduce a younger generation to jazz.
I think in some cases it has. I mean, I get emails occasionally from around the world. In fact, there was one woman who did her master's thesis on my books, and this English writer friend of mine sent me a copy of her thesis, and it was called Cool Cats in the Mean Streets. She totally analyzed all the books, and I was amazed at some of the stuff that she came up with. I don't know of anybody other writer who's writing about jazz from the inside with a major character being a jazz musician. There are several writers who have jazz in their books, but having Evan as the protagonist has, I think, separated my books from the herd, you know, at least. But I'm still what's known in publishing as a niche writer or mid-list writer, unless the Chet Baker book's been optioned for a film. And if that ever happens, then it will change the whole picture of things.
Bill, are all your books in print? And if so, where would people find them?
Yeah, they're all in print. They're certainly on all over on Amazon and at bookstores. There's Reader's Books in Sonoma. I always do a reading there. They carry them. Barnes & Noble in Santa Rosa's got them, or they can get them. So they're all out there. And you might have to look for him a little harder than you would for Stephen King or John Grisham.
And if somebody wanted to start on the Evan Horn mystery series, which book would you recommend they begin with?
Some people prefer to start from the beginning with Solo Hand, but it doesn't really matter. You can pick any of them out. And I usually make reference to previous books at some point in the book, so it doesn't really matter which one you start, as long as you start with one of them.
So they each stand on their own.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Moody, thanks so much for sharing your life journey. Bill, would you be interested in telling your readers about your radio show?
Sure.
Do you podcast it? Do you stream it?
It is streamed. I'm on KSVY in Sonoma Thursday nights from 10 to midnight. And the show is called Stolen Moments in Jazz. I've sort of described it as bebop and beyond.
And I think it is true that the Bay Area, if one wants to explore the world of jazz, there is no better area than the Bay Area. We have a 24-hour jazz station in KCSM. Here at KRCB, we have Jazz Connections every Saturday from 8 to midnight. Bill Moody's on Sonoma. And, of course, we have some of the best jazz clubs in San Francisco. And we have the Healdsburg Jazz Festival every year. So tune in if you want to get exposed to jazz and pick up a Bill Moody book. Bill, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Larry. You can visit Bill online at billmoodyjazz.com. You are listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB. Among the Wonderful is a fictional account of P.T. Barnum's American Museum, which for a brief period in the 19th century was America's reigning public attraction. Author Stacy Carlson takes us through a tale of humanity and spectacle at their confluence. Later in the broadcast, we'll hear Rosemary Manchester's conversation with Elizabeth Kern about her book, Wanting to Be Jackie Kennedy. And also ahead is Barbara Quick's review of Belinda McKeon's novel, Solace. But right now, let's listen to my conversation with Stacy Carlson. Welcome. You are the author of Among the Wonderful.
Yes.
And some of the wonderful that your book is about are the human, I will call them oddities, and not just people, but things and items and animals that all inhabit this world of the American Museum, P.T. Barnum's American Museum in New York City. And I don't remember the date being mentioned, but I'm guessing around the 1850s?
1840-41, yeah. The date is left a little bit ambiguous, but right around then.
And this is a real place that did exist in New York City.
Yeah, it takes place at this wonderful antebellum moment that I was fascinated by when Manhattan had undergone a few formative fires that really transformed the city, and the sort of upper echelon of society was moving out of downtown right at sort of the moment that the book takes place, a sort of commuter culture was being formed.
You have some major characters in the book, one of them, the giantess, Anna Swift, who is 8 feet tall.
Seven and a half.
Seven and a half.
Yes.
And her life really has been one of spectacle. And for her moving into the museum, which P.T. Barnum has taken over, for her, it's almost a step up.
Yes, definitely. Before her arrival at Barnum's Museum, she had been under the fairly tight reign of a manager, and actually a series of managers going back for the last 17 years of her professional career. But when she arrives at Barnum's Museum, for the first time, she's working without one. So on the one hand, she is excited by that prospect. On the other, she's been performing long enough that she knows she's still a spectacle. But now, how will she exercise more autonomy about her day?
And it seems the expectation is different as well for her. Whereas in the past, she would be on exhibit. Now she's walking around in almost a naturalized way, and that's what her job is. Mm-hmm. And P.T. Barnum, who I will say we don't really see a lot of him until towards the end of the book,
P.T. Barnum is wanting to create this fantastic environment where you don't just look at an exhibit, but they're really all around you. So this was new for her in a way, but not so new, because that's her experience of people being shocked and being stared at. So what is it that drew you to writing about a giantess?
Well, a couple of things. When I started reading P.T. Barnum's autobiography, which is the catalyst really for this idea blossoming in my imagination, of course I encountered all of his human marvels, and in particular a giantess figure, a historical woman named Anna Swan. So my character Anna Swift is really in direct homage to this person and inspired by her stature and, if not her, exact life trajectory. So I really became fascinated by her and the idea of a female giant, a giantess, as a professional woman at this time in the mid-19th century is unusual enough. And then, of course, someone, you know, larger than life and someone who has become very much accustomed to and jaded by this world of spectators. And so I was very interested in how does this woman maintain a kernel of hope about the world, about herself, her life. One of the things she ponders throughout the book is there a possibility for a life outside of the public eye, basically? And she has various encounters and explorations of that hope. That was one of the main things I was attracted to. I also loved the challenge of portraying someone who really was in chronic pain. When I first thought about it, I thought, oh, yeah, you know, because on every page you can't just say, her leg hurt, her back hurt, it hurt more, it hurt again. That, of course, is not very interesting. So I grabbed onto this challenge of how could I manifest this in a way that wouldn't be oppressive to the reader. It would actually be just interesting discovery of her world and the things she dealt with on a daily basis.
And you do that in a very naturalized way that does allow the reader to relate to this character. And I'm going to come back to this in a minute because I want to bring up the other, though the book has lots of colorful characters, the other primary character I'm going to say, and I'm going to ask you to pronounce his name for me, is Emil.
Guido.
Thank you.
Yes.
who is the taxidermist. And he had been with the museum before P.T. Barnum took it over, and he had made all the exhibits and stuffed all the animals. And he goes through a bit of a life crisis and a professional crisis. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck. The structure of your narrative breaks them apart so that in the book, the giantess, Anna Swift, is talking to us in the first person, but then when we experience things not exactly through the eyes of Guido, but that is much more from a different point of view. So tell me a little bit about what drew you to structure the book this way.
Yeah. When I began, the main character that I started with was the museum. And I just fell in love with this labyrinthine cabinet of wonders, just overflowing with pretty much anything you could imagine, a Pandora's box type of world. And I really was reeling in that world for the first few months that I wrestled with this idea and really had to make sure I stayed focused on the human stories contained within the museum. But I think the museum itself is more than just the setting of the book. It's a vibrant and always developing, always changing atmosphere. So once I got my bearings in the world of this museum, I wanted to really have two points of view, one that encompassed a little bit more of a distance and perspective with the museum. And I chose a third-person angle on that for Emil Guido. In fact, when you open the book, you start as he's walking up to the museum. So you very much start on the outside. You get his thoughts and his take on the new owner, P.T. Barnum. Then you go inside the museum and you get a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. And then I chose to switch point of views as he got into this part of the museum where Barnum's human marvels actually live. And that's where the baton gets passed for the first time to Anna Swift, who represents a very much internal, the sort of the deepest layer of the museum. So that was a starting vision for how I wanted to bring the reader deeper and deeper into the place. And also, Guido it seemed very natural to me to use third person for him. I don't know if I can explain it all that well.
Because he has a difficulty with intimacy, or because maybe
perhaps
he himself has a sense of remove?
I think that it definitely developed in my awareness a little bit later. You know, sometimes these kernels, these choices, these initial choices are as much on instinct as on rational thought. So I think that's very true. And I was able to inflect the authorial flavor in the spaces between his voice and that third person. And I think I chose that partially, but because of how much I love and am fascinated by the sort of element of futility in his perspective, in the sense that here is this taxidermist obsessed with order, taxonomy. He's very grumpy. He really does not like the direction the museum is starting to go under P.T. Barnum. And so he's grasping very tightly to this idea that everything can be categorized and put in their rightful place. And, of course, that worldview is completely toppled by Barnum and the advent of modern entertainment and the modern age in a way. I guess I wanted to also have a little bit of a say in depicting that in the book.
Because it really is quite a contrast from when Anna's talking. And we really do get a very personal view of her reflections upon her own life and about the life around mm-hmm. her. And she's really a very strong woman, not just because she's a giantess, but it's just the nature of her personality. And it seems like that was something you were exploring as well, the difficult situations of people, yet the individuality that they bring to this odd circumstance that they found themselves in, and in fact, the community that they built.
Yes, that's very true. Among the community of wonders that live in the museum, I was just very, very interested in the way that their individual voices created their community. And I guess, by contrast, when you read about Barnum's actual museum in books, you don't get those voices. You usually, in much of the literature about Barnum's actual museum, you get the same sort of descriptions of what was in there, these catalogs, and these wonderfully short descriptions of the things that are the most fascinating, like the beluga whale. He actually had a beluga whale in his museum, and some of the human wonders that he employed. And their voices aren't really there, and you don't tend to hear them in a lot of the literature of the very early circus or things like that. And so I really wanted to explore their voices, and through Anna Swift's writing her own memoir, this idea of someone actually putting forth this document about their own life instead of the usual hand of history, you know, giving her one or two sentences and a photo.
In her professional life as a spectacle, she was had this fictional bio, or, you know, there was always something about, you know, raised by druids or, mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, P.T. Barnum, even though his whole thing was spectacle and even a little bit of artifice, let's say, mm-hmm. she felt the freedom within that context to actually tell her story, mm-hmm. maybe for the first time.
Part of what is so interesting about that context is that Barnum creates this museum, and then he is sort of absent. My love of Barnum as a fictional character really is as conjuring him as a trickster figure, more behind the scenes, known by word of mouth, but it's his world. He is a maker and a creator. But he's kind of a negligent parent as well. If the museum is his child, it just runs free, runs wild. And so some of these performers have the freedom to ponder and do what they will. At one point in the book, Anna is reading poetry from her booth as her own sort of performance within a performance. Now, it doesn't go over that well, but she feels free enough to do that. Also, Barnum has a band playing on the balcony, which is one of my favorite little details of the book, part of this sort of huge ensemble cast where this musician is playing out over the balcony. So he's not even playing for museum patrons. He's just playing to the people on Broadway.
And there are a lot of animals and the challenges that live animals bring into a situation. And And they, along with some of the characters, do not meet a good end. And there definitely is a dark side to all this. And I think some of the relationships in the book also were tragic. The end of the book was very surprising to me. I just wondered, as the author, it seems like you're taking us on this journey, but really making us reflect on maybe the nature of captivity, the nature mm-hmm. of control. Mm-hmm. No, it's certainly what I was left with.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I appreciate hearing that. And part of my intention is to imagine this moment, like I said, when the modern age of entertainment is brought into America, and with it, a lot of these questions about spectacle and human exhibit and this conflation of entertainment and education and advertising. I mean, it starts to sound very familiar to our 21st century sensibility.
It certainly does.
And the human lives that get caught up in the mechanism of this transition, and some sort of chewed up and spit out, some persevere into the modern age relatively unscathed, and others are dying away.
And there was also this thread of, and I want to let our listeners know, there's lots of different threads mm-hmm. in this book to follow, suggesting some of the events and topics of the time. It also does evoke a time in New York City before it was really New York City. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of lovely. I bet you enjoyed doing research on that.
Oh, research was so fun for the entire book, and especially I think you're referring to a portion of the book where Emile Guillaudeau goes on a bit of a walkabout up into the upper reaches of Manhattan Island, which really hasn't been urbanized yet. It was very fun. I found some amazing journals and diaries from the late 18th century and early 19th century that chronicle the wildlife of Manhattan. Describe the Harlem grasslands or the Harlem savannah. It just was wonderful fodder for the book, and I'm glad that there was a space for it in the book.
Well, and it does leave one with a sense of longing, truly. And we're talking about Stacy Carlson's book, Among the Wonderful. And Stacy, what are you working on now? Where are you going now with your writing?
Well, I am working on a new novel, and I've been working on it for the last couple of years. Right now I'm facing a wonderful challenge. I have a 9-month-old baby, so if there are other women writers out there, they understand that certainly a reconfiguration of my writing life. But thankfully, I've been continuing to write, and my new book is also set in the 19th century, but this time the 1890s, and it's set in the Arctic. In the European Arctic, so very different.
When can we expect that, a year or so?
Oh, I wish. Probably a few years.
How long did it take you to write Among the Wonderful?
About 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then another couple years to find an agent and a publisher. And that journey was a story in itself.
But you made it.
I did.
You made it. Well, Stacy Carlson, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
You can follow Stacy Carlson at www.amongthewonderful.com. You're listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB. In 1961, John F. Kennedy inspires America's young people to give back to their country, and Jackie Kennedy became an idol to many a young girl. The down-to-earth life of an American family set in an ethnic Polish neighborhood of Chicago is juxtaposed against the privileged lives of the Kennedys in Elizabeth Kern's Wanting to Be Jackie Kennedy. Let's listen to Rosemary Manchester in conversation with the author.
Elizabeth, what a great title.
Thank you, Rosemary. It just sort of came to me in a flash.
Now, you probably... or I should say your protagonist, probably was not the only young woman in the 60s who wanted to be Jackie Kennedy.
Ellie was one of many. Ellie was one of hundreds of thousands in the world who wanted to be Jackie Kennedy about that time. And you remember the Jackie Kennedy look when people would wear their pillbox hats and their very stylish, sleek, simple clothing. It was a time of change. We were sort of done with Eisenhower and Truman and those people. Eisenhower and Truman and their wives looked sort of grandmotherly and grandfatherly yes. then to teenagers. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of idealism those years.
Yes.
And I was among them, and my character, Ellie yes. Menikowski, yes. was among them too.
Yes. And Jackie was so beautiful.
She was. She was young and beautiful and gracious and charming. And she had a soft-spoken voice. And there was a gentleness about her that was very appealing then. She was a woman of the 60s.
And so your story takes place in Chicago.
Yes, it does, on the northwest side of Chicago in the oldest Polish neighborhood, and probably one of the oldest Polish neighborhoods in the country. If you know Chicago, it's around Milwaukee Division and Ashland. Between North Avenue and Division Street, you'll see a whole lot of church steeples. And those churches were built by a lot of the Polish immigrants right around the turn of the century.
Yeah. And they're in your story.
And they're in my story. Yes. It was really a small town, a town of its own, within this vastness of Chicago.
And your protagonist, Ellie, is a young woman. At the beginning of the book, is she early teens or is she in high school already?
She's in high school
high
already,
school,
yes.
Which is a difficult time for anyone.
Yes, she's a junior in high school.
So there's a lot of drama and trauma involved simply with being a teenager. And presented in the context of the Polish community in Chicago, living in a funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting
environment
yes, that you created there.
And that is very real because I grew up above a funeral home.
Oh, you did?
Yes,
I
did. My father and his brothers were in the funeral business,
yes.
and their father was in the funeral business too. And an interesting story there is my grandfather was a saloon keeper. And Prohibition came, and they had to shut down a lot of the saloons.
Yes.
So a lot of the saloons in this Polish neighborhood in Chicago were closed down, and the buddies got together, and they went to mortuary school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up with all these guys owning funeral homes.
I read someplace recently, or maybe I heard this, that the ethnic groups who were fairly new in this country and perhaps not as cognizant with language as they wanted to be,
mm-hmm.
had two opportunities. One was a funeral home, and the other was insurance.
Oh.
And that, it kind of makes sense, because mm-hmm. they'd be working among people with whom they shared a heritage and a language. They would be trusted
yes.
because of their ethnic identity.
Yes.
So when I read about this story taking place in a funeral home,
yes.
I thought, yeah.
That's very true.
That's
very true, because my whole life,
mm-hmm.
and I know Ellie's too,
mm-hmm.
was a very contained kind of life in a very homogeneous group of people.
Yes.
Who spoke a certain way, who did business with each other.
Yes.
And that's very mm-hmm. much how it is, mm-hmm. and I think you raised a good point about mm-hmm. the language. They
yes.
were comfortable
mm-hmm.
doing business right. in their native language with each other.
Yes.
And that started to change. That was very much different, you know, during mm-hmm. Ellie's time.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were starting to move to the suburbs. Their world was getting a little larger.
Yes.
Ellie was a curious young lady who
yes.
liked to read, who wanted a big life,
mm-hmm.
who admired, you know, what was going on in the large, glamorous world of Jackie Kennedy,
yes.
and also wanted to do public service. You know, she
mm-hmm.
wanted to go to the Peace Corps. She
yes.
wanted to be a mother, mm-hmm. Mother Teresa, who wore stylish clothes. she was ready. She was exploding. She
yes.
was just ready to get out there. And her
yes.
family was holding her back a
yes.
little bit.
Yes. And they, with the best of intentions,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they wanted her to continue to be safe and,
yes.
and protected. And then when she learns that her father, who is the head of the funeral home, had actually wanted to be an
mm-hmm.
attorney
mm-hmm.
and wasn't able to realize his ambition because his father mm-hmm. said, "This is a family business."
That's right.
And then when she heard that from her father, she questioned if her dreams of going to college were going to work out, because
right.
she realized that the family wanted her to stay right there and be
mm-hmm.
a part of the business.
Mm-hmm. Her father probably wanted that, and her mother just wanted her to be protected.
Yes.
And to stay with her own.
Yes.
And that didn't go over real well with Ellie.
Mm-hmm. And you created a wonderful group of relatives, friends. Throughout the book, people are coming and going. There's a lot of cooking, and it sounded like wonderful things were were being prepared in the kitchens, a lot of emphasis on gathering and eating and celebrating mm-hmm. And exchanging information, mm-hmm. supporting each other.
Mm-hmm. And joke telling.
Oh, yes, lots of
humor. During that time, people told jokes. Mm-hmm. And in Ellie's family, they told funeral jokes, too.
Well, they're amusing because they were so lame.
Exactly.
On the other hand, it would be hard to be too witty about the funeral business.
That's right. That's right. But mm-hmm. upstairs was different than downstairs.
Yes. And there was only one phone.
That's right.
In the book, in the
That's
funeral
right.
home in the book.
That's right.
And so if Ellie wanted to have a conversation, her father's tapping his foot and saying 5 minutes mm-hmm. because a call might come in for mm-hmm. business.
That's right.
I think that's one of the details in the book that makes people realize how different life is today, how communication was so limited yes. that there was one telephone that was for business. And when she and her friend Joy wanted to talk, they went out and rode on the bus.
That's correct. They rode on the bus because they had privacy.
Yes.
No one was interrupting them. They had mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And they did it all on a 25-cent bus ticket.
Weren't they
smart? That took them to the end of the line and back.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to know the bus drivers.
Oh, sure.
And they had a favorite seat on the bus.
Yes.
And that's when they would talk mm-hmm. to each other the way girls talk.
Yeah, and the driver was watching over them and making sure that no one gave them any trouble. Mm-hmm. It was a charming detail. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated the amount of detail you had. The names of the songs that were popular, the singers, the dances, uh-huh. the fashion, the hairdos, mm-hmm. How people behaved and spoke.
Uh-huh. For me, research is very important and also very exciting.
Well, you did it so well that I had complete confidence. Uh-huh. So that you weren't just making that up.
No, I wasn't. And, right. and of course, even the Polish songs, you know, from the Polish wedding scene.
Yes, that was a great scene. I'm so glad you had a Polish wedding in there.
You couldn't have a Polish mm-hmm. book without a Polish wedding.
This book would make a great movie.
Thank you. I've thought about that, too, and other people have said that as mm-hmm. well.
But it's a career change for you, isn't it, to spend your life writing novels? Before you did that, you had your own career. You were with Apple, is that right?
I was with Apple until mm-hmm. about 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did you do?
I mm-hmm. managed the employee communications department.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And this and this was the communicating to all the employees within Apple worldwide. When I left Apple, I just needed repotting after about 8 years at Apple. And it was time to just take a breath and to do something else. So
yes.
my husband and I moved from the Bay Area uh-huh. Up here to Petaluma. Uh-huh. And we just changed our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a wonderful mm-hmm. place to live. And that's when I started writing. That's when I had the mental space to think about new things.
I think it makes so much sense to start a writing career after you've had some experience out there in the world. And it seems to me that so many young people who are launching themselves into writing these days, it's too soon. They don't have enough experience of living to launch themselves into creative writing. And I think that for more mature people, I think it's a little easier.
I think it is, too, and I think you really hit the point. I could have never written wanting to be Jackie Kennedy as a younger person
mm-hmm.
because the story is really told in two voices. It's told
yes.
in mm-hmm. Ellie's voice
yes.
as a teenager,
right.
and it's told in the voice of the 50-year-old Ellie Manikoski looking back at herself, remembering
yes.
herself,
yes.
how she was then,
mm-hmm.
and also looking at what she thought and what the world was like then. And over the decades,
mm-hmm.
her ideas changed.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are constant strains mm-hmm. that run through, and I think those strains have to do with character. You may change your attitudes, but your character
right.
is pretty set, mm-hmm. I think, based mm-hmm. on who you were then. And
mm-hmm.
like her mother points out, mm-hmm. you just become more of what you were.
Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy thing to do.
No.
I mean, that takes a great deal of skill. I noticed in your notes that you're studying with Susan Bono.
You're
one of the Bono Bunch.
I'm one of the Bono Bunch.
And what an outstanding group of writers that is.
Most of us are working on long pieces, on novels, and we meet twice a month, and we're very honest with each other about giving good advice and about, you know, offering criticism, too, and making suggestions about how we could do things better.
And how long has your group been together with Susan?
I think I've been there the longest of all of them. And the group as it is now has been together probably about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there probably about 8 years. As a corporate writer, your writing is very different. As a journalist, your writing is very different. And I've had to learn how to write dialogue. Mm-hmm. I've had to learn to pay attention to detail.
Yes.
To do description. Mm-hmm. I've had to learn to create plot.
Yes.
And suspense.
Mm-hmm. You learn what to leave out.
Does it further the story? So you learn to ask yourself that and to be a little tougher with yourself. And if you're not tough with yourself, your buddies will be. Your writing buddies will be.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the milieu of your story in Chicago. It seems to me that people are paying a lot more attention to Chicago these days. I think it has something to do with our president mm-hmm. and the fact that he and his wife lived in Chicago and probably mm-hmm. still think of it as home. Then there are a number of novels now that are set in Chicago. Do you plan to go to Chicago and read?
I would love to go to Chicago and read. I've been so busy doing publicity in this area. But yes, I have to get, because I know there's a huge audience there.
I thought the way that you built the story around the events that we all remember concerning the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
Ellie was so delighted with the inauguration that... She went to the inauguration, didn't she?
She didn't go to the inauguration. She was at home watching it on TV.
That's right. That was at the
beginning.
In
her family room. That was the second chapter. And it was Kennedy's assassination.
Oh, yes. That's what compelled her to go.
That's what compelled her to go. Jackie and the Kennedys had been such a part of her years there
mm-hmm.
that she felt... I've got to do something. I've got to pay my respects.
She got
and
on the
she
bus.
Knew about funerals. She knew about the importance of paying your respect, you know, to the surviving family and honoring the deceased. And so she got herself together and got on the Greyhound bus. She was also very familiar with buses and rode to Washington, D.C.,
and she was familiar with trouble in the family.
She was.
Because in her own family... We're not going to give away the plot, of course.
You all will
have to read this book for yourselves. But she encounters hypocrisy, mm-hmm. heartbreak, people having to rise to an occasion they never expected to face. And then I was thinking about, at the very end of the book, there's an assassination.
That's right.
In the family.
That's right.
And at first... When I first read that, it didn't reverberate with mm-hmm. me because I was just, so heartbroken mm-hmm. for her. But then I was thinking about the parallels between the families.
Right.
And I think, yes, you had to have that in the story to show that Ellie was sharing the pain
yes.
of her idol,
yes.
Jackie Kennedy.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and I think one of the scene that I remember touching me the most was when Ellie was on the bus riding to Washington, D.C., and she was sitting in her bus seat, and the bus was zooming along the highway, and the lights were flickering on her, and she had the newspaper in her lap with Jackie's picture. She was wearing the suit that was covered with blood that she wore when her husband was killed.
Yes.
And Ellie picked up that mm-hmm. newspaper and held it close to her.
The pink suit.
The pink suit.
Yes. That's such an iconic moment, isn't it? We'll just never forget that pink suit.
That's right. That's right.
Covered with blood.
It took mm-hmm. me about 5 years to write this book, but in the first version, I didn't have that chapter, nor did I have the assassination in it. And one of my readers at that point encouraged me to take the book on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was right. I resisted for a while.
Yeah.
But I took the book on.
Mm-hmm.
And then that allowed me to begin the book differently with Ellie as an adult woman,
yes,
looking back.
Yes.
So it created another dimension to the
yes.
story, another mm-hmm. level to
yeah.
the story.
And for me, that really worked.
And I think it worked.
Yes, because I wanted to know what happened to Ellie uh-huh. afterwards, and this is so uh-huh. much more graceful. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you about your book, about the craft of writing, about how you came to writing and how you came to this particular book, wanting to be Jackie Kennedy.
Rosemary, I can't thank you enough. The pleasure is mine.
Well, thank you for yes. coming in. Let me tell our readers, we're talking with Elizabeth Kern. Her book is called Wanting to Be Jackie Kennedy. Wanting to Be Jackie Kennedy. I love that. Yes. And I certainly wish you well.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Thank you, Rosemary. And you can visit ElizabethKern.com for more on Wanting to Be Jackie Kennedy. Finally, novelist and screenwriter Barbara Quick with her review of Belinda McKeon's Solace.
What a difficult thing it is to write or even find a new novel that delivers everything we long for when we open a book for the first time and begin to read. My senses were humming with pleasure when I found myself in the rural landscape of the Irish Midlands, so lushly and beautifully evoked in Solace, the first novel by the young playwright and scholar Belinda McKeon. The novel begins with a prologue, set on a hardscrabble farm, told from the third-person point of view of Tom Casey, a man who seems to have grown out of the earth itself. McKeon has created an enduring character in Tom, a man who finds all his solace in the rhythms of farming, who only knows one way to love, the way of the patriarch, whose wife must make him feel that all the decisions are his, even while he asks her silently to step in and do those things that he finds difficult, talking on the phone, calling their grown son home from Dublin to do what Tom stubbornly clings to believing a farmer's son must do, tend the land and the cattle, follow in the muddy footsteps of his father, which Tom and all the ancestors who came before him did in their turn. But Tom's feckless son, Mark, is bent on living the life of a scholar, slogging his own messy way toward a doctorate in literature. Sadly for the reader, Mark is the book's main character. When the gorgeous 13 pages of the prologue are over, we're dropped into Mark's world, a place where a lot of rootless people are texting and getting drunk and doing their best to get laid. There are glimpses of McKeon's wondrous ability and solace, a laugh high and fearful of how best to land, her evocation of the relationship between parent and child comprised of equal parts of love, irritation, and guilt. But like the self-consciously cool young Dubliners she describes, McKeon is overly careful to steer clear of emotional engagement in what should have been a truly moving story. With this first novel, she has shown the world her skills as a writer. With her next book, I hope she'll actually open a vein and write from the deepest places inside her without caution. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
You've been listening to A Novel Idea. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.